Hello, and welcome to a special edition of Media Talk, live-ish from the Guardian Student Media Conference, as the very best of the next generation of Toynbees, Paxmen and Brookers prepare to take their first steps into an industry in crisis. We'll look for the upside to the downturn and ask, what will the media landscape look like in 5 years' time? Can new media help turn the tide of doom and gloom? And what does Rupert Murdoch's proposed deal with Microsoft mean for the future of free online news? We have an all-star panel to share their views and experiences. I'm Matt Wells. This is Media Talk from The Guardian. Thank you very much. Thank you. We are back in the bowels of The Guardian's King's Place HQ for another of our not-quite-live and not-quite-outside broadcasts. And I'm here with the very cream of oversexed, overdrawn and underworked bright young things. But enough of our panel. We're here at the Guardian Student Media Conference. There's no point lying about it. This is a desperate time for the media industry. Jobs are being cut, budgets are being slashed, and still no one really knows how to make the internet pay. But we will be casting for chinks of light as we look into the future. So to our panel, everyone in this audience is eager to make a career in the media, so I thought we should probably start by hearing about your own journey into journalism, and perhaps we should do it in descending order of experience. So Emily Bell, you're a bona fide big cheese now, aren't you? The director of digital content for The Guardian. But back in the day, it was all about Big Farm Weekly.
It was. But I started in journalism. It just goes to prove that it's not what you know, it's who you know. I started in journalism on the International Thomson Business Publications Training Scheme. Unfortunately, it wasn't on the much more glamorous Meat Trades Journal, but the next to it, Big Farm Weekly. And I got through my interview because the man interviewed me, who was a news editor, had a very unusual surname.
What was that?
Van den Bos. Van den Bos. And I said, are you any relation to Sean Van den Bos? And he looked a bit surprised and said, yes, he's my brother. How do you know him? And I said, he sells tractors to my granddad.
Excellent way in.
That was my way in.
How you get in. Well, we'll get on to the rest of your career in a minute. Richard Bacon, you presented Blue Peter and Top of the Pops. You're one of the biggest stars on Radio 5 Live. But more excitingly, you were on the thick of it.
I was. Yeah, I was on the thick of it.
How was the
recent episode. Yeah, it was good fun. And this very building was on the thick of it as well. As I pulled up, I got a taxi bike here. That's quite flash. But anyway, I pulled up outside and I thought, oh my God, I've seen that building in the thick of it.
But am I right in thinking, though, that your big break in the media was not in any of those things, but that you owe your media career to Calvin McKenzie?
A little bit, yeah. Well, my first media job was BBC Local Radio, which is, if you want to work in radio, there's no better way in, and they have a really good standard of journalism as well. But my telly break was at was in live TV, and the channel was called Live. Do you remember that, Emily?
I went round. Janet took me round when you were just starting.
I joined after Janet. I think
were
Janet
you the
got
man in the rabbit suit.
Oh, occasionally,
News Bunny.
You were News Bunny.
Well, I tried out, but I mean, I was a reporter, but they let me have a go at being News Bunny. Well, either let me have a go or the work experience didn't turn up and I had no choice but to be News Bunny. But
the audience have no idea what we're talking about.
Well, Alex, too young.
Before you were born...
You missed nothing. Private Eye talked about it every week and they always referred to it as piss poor live TV. And it was a low rent cable channel run by Janet Street Porter and then Kelvin McKenzie, who used to edit The Sun famously in the 80s. And it tried to be everything with no budget. It even tried pitching for the premiership. Right? This is just at one point, it was a cable channel with no money. And it had its own soap opera called Canary Wharf, because we were based in Canary Wharf. And I was in the newsroom as a reporter, and they would film. They didn't have any sets, so they filmed the soap opera around the office. So one day I was writing the news bulletin, and there were two people having sex at the end of the desk.
Because when you say soap opera, it was basically people with no clothes on, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was, yeah. Just lots of shagging.
So that's Rich Bacon's starting career. You also heard there, interrupting, Benjamin Cohn, who's the technology correspondent for Channel 4 News. But you started an...
Yeah, you were going to say I've read your script.
Internet porn.
I didn't start a career in internet porn. I was a founder of a business that, among other things, provided search engine for internet porn. But it was actually at the time the only way that you could separate porn from the rest of family safe searching. Yeah, anyway, you can find porn through Google. But that didn't start my journalism career.
No, absolutely.
But that was a legal dispute with Apple.
It's the most interesting part of your career. Josh Halliday is 20 and still a student. Why would you want to be a journalist, Josh, when the media industry is in such a crisis?
The chance of working to someone who provides search engines for porn.
Yeah,
really.
you could be an internet porn. You could be a news bunny, or you could work on a farm magazine. Which would be the?
Can I be all three?
All right. Listen, that's our panel. You mentioned we mentioned the kind of nepotism thing. It was brought up this morning. Emily, do you think that if, you know, getting ahead in journalism these days, in the days of when everyone can blog, everyone can Twitter, is it still about who you know, do you think? Or have those days gone?
No, I don't think, and I think to some extent, what I was going to say, I was about to say it never was about that, but that would be a complete lie, because actually I think it was one of those things where journalism, it's not like being a doctor, it's a sort of a craft rather than a profession. So actually, that's what Peter Preston, the former editor of the Guardian, always used to say about it. So there was quite a lot of sort of nepotism, but I just think now the competition is so ferocious that, you know, quality, you have to have the best people. And I was just saying to Josh, actually, but beforehand, that one of the things I've been quite impressed by is certainly seeing a lot of graduates on postgraduate courses and people on undergraduate courses now. I think you have to really, really want to be a journalist. You know, if you're doing it and you're just sort of pissing about, you're not going to have a career. I think that there's much more kind of, there's a much keener competition now, and there's actually the quality of people that we see now who are starting out in their careers, I think, is really significantly higher than it was maybe kind of, you know, sort of 5, 10 years ago.
I should explain to the audience downloading at home that the audience here is commenting and tweeting, and their comments can appear on a big screen behind us, which can be mildly distracting. But Richard, I sort of got the impression that you were sort of shaking your head a bit there.
Someone's put news bunny porn.
Yeah.
That sounds...
They're trolling for followers.
Yeah. Yeah. I was shaking my head because there is a lot of nepotism, and I think it is largely still about who you know.
Who do you know?
That's what I've literally got.
You're not on Radio 5 in the afternoons because of who you know, are you?
No, I've been around for ages, and so, but my way in, my dad is a solicitor, and he got me a day's work experience at a BBC local radio station, and admittedly, from then on, I've obviously cracked on and worked pretty hard. But, you know, it was through him that I got the work experience in the first place.
Yeah, the nepotism, that's quite low. I think Dad was a solicitor, got me onto local, I don't know.
I still felt as though it was helpful, though, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, I can see that. But
there is a lot of nepotism. You know, look at News Corporation. When Rupert Murdoch was looking for someone to inherit that empire, you know, he cast the net far and wide. Yeah. It just so happens that the best person for the job was in his house.
Yeah,
you know, and so it still exists.
Ben, do you agree or not?
Pardon?
Do you agree?
I agree with Richard, because I only doing my job really because my company was in a legal dispute with Apple, happened to be interviewed by the Times. They said it's our Christmas party, do you want to come tonight? Met the business editor of Times Online, said do you want to write a column, and so forth. And you've obviously got to have some talent.
That's networking, though. That's not nepotism.
Well, no,
I didn't say who's your dad.
It's kind of...
Is his name Rupert?
I don't think that you necessarily get everywhere. I don't think I'm necessarily the most skilled technology correspondent that you'd ever get, but it's just through a series of flukes who you happen to meet. Once you meet those first few contacts...
Take nepotism out of it, but let's just focus on who you know.
Different issue.
Yeah.
I think different issue. I think how you network, if you can't network... you're not going to be a very effective journalist.
I didn't say it was necessarily networking. It's just you just... fate throws you a particular chance and you meet someone and it's just an accident.
And look at the proportion of people at the BBC who went to private school versus the proportion of people in the country as a whole. I think 6% of people go to private school, and I don't know the percentage of people within the BBC, but on my show it's about 40%.
Josh, do you come from a big journalistic background? Or?
Absolutely not. I come from the arse end of Bradford, right? And how easy is it to make your own network and make your own look? I mean, if you work hard, you beaver away at it online, you'll get into these networks with people like Emily and people like Peter Bale from Microsoft. That's just from being interested in and being part of the conversations that they're having online. And they'll follow you on Twitter. I mean, that's a big thing now.
How many people follow you on Twitter?
About 1,150, I think.
That's pretty good for for somebody who isn't actually a professional journalist.
Yeah, I've not really achieved anything yet, so that's quite good.
Richard Bacon, meanwhile, how did you become the number one Twitterer in Britain? He has more followers than Stephen Fry.
I know. I was in a restaurant two nights ago on the table next to Stephen Fry.
Yes.
And
if a bomb had landed on that restaurant, Twitter would have exploded.
Well, I'm surprised Twitter allowed us both to be in the same place at the same time. It's like putting all the royal family on one aeroplane.
Yeah.
No, I remember thinking he must be devastated to be the second most popular person on Twitter within a 2 meter radius.
Yeah, I did see that. Yeah.
I got very lucky. About a year ago, I talked a lot about Twitter in the press in interviews, and they put me on their suggested user site. So if you want to get, the secret is, if you want to get over 1 million followers on Twitter, you have to get on Twitter's suggested user site. And what that means is that people from all around the world follow you who don't know who they are. So I'll be on Twitter commenting on some TV program I'm watching, and people in South Korea haven't got the first clue what I'm banging on about. But that is how you get over 1 million.
Well, as we've been hearing today and just now, but it's been kind of it's run like a thread throughout all the sessions today. The big change since we all started in journalism, well, most of us on this panel anyway, and those who are starting now, is this shift in power from us to the audience. We hear a lot of talk about Twitter, but there's no getting away from it, Emily, is there, that it's become a really powerful journalistic tool. How do you think it's changed the game?
Oh, I think it's changed the game in every aspect. And, you see the aspects every day that the mainstream media can't really handle, which is it's changed the economics of it for a start. So barriers to entry very, very low. Anyone can do it. Someone like Josh, who's very smart and actually sort of consistently tweets really good links, will be, that there are lots and lots and lots of ways that it should make mainstream media set up and take notice and do things differently. I still think that there is a bit of a... I mean, it's quite interesting, actually, when you look at how we all behave. When I say we all, the sort of mainstream media behaves on Twitter, there's still a little bit of a broadcast instinct there, which is, kind of telling and ta-da, rather than actually sort of, networking and listening
to
people.
We're trying to see what Channel 4 is, or Channel 4 News, is it's being part of a conversation. And that's why, although we may not have squillions of followers, we seem to be doing it better. Look at the BBC, look at Laura Kunzberg. She's just broadcasting lines. It's just fact.
So what do you do? Do you do it under the name of Channel 4 News?
I do just at Benjamin Cohen. And
because, can I say something on this? I mean,
this is really
we've got big debate.
This is really interesting. Do you do it as yourself, as the broadcaster, or do you do it as Channel 4 News, the programme?
I'm as me in the programme. It's not me.
But is there a Channel 4
there is
News Twitter
Channel 4
feed
News,
as well?
Which is quite popular.
Because I have a bit of a problem with that, because I don't think that's what Twitter's about. Five Live have one, under the Five Live logo. I don't really like that either. And I think that Twitter is about individuals talking. It's about people. It's not about organisations. And I think that will put people off.
But what happens? Well, what happens when you get, poached by a big money deal from GMTV? And
no amount of money will take me to GMTV, Matt.
To pluck a news organisation out of the air. Would you take your followers with you, or do you owe your followers to the BBC? Well, should the BBC claim some of your followers?
It's a good question. It's a good question because, really, I suppose I got on. I was interested in Twitter because I read about it, but then I quickly got up to about 20,000 followers by talking about Twitter on the radio, and then for reasons we've discussed, I've now got quite a lot. And also, having quite a few followers begets more followers because they all see who each other is following. Mm. And so once you get to a certain threshold, you kind of grow exponentially. I suppose I do owe it to them. But then again, the people that follow me now, those in the UK that follow me because I put some personal details on there. So it's about me, not really about Five Live. But I'll say this, in terms of it changing the game, it has changed the game, I think, in a really exciting way. And take the Jan Moyer article with the Daily Mail. That felt as though Twitter became quite an effective press regulator. That matter has gone to the PCC. I'd be amazed if they did anything. But the reality is the Daily Mail will have been a bit spooked by that, and they might think twice about putting an article like that out now, and they'll think twice because of what happened on Twitter and the amount of people that complained.
Josh, the mainstream media is talking constantly about Twitter now. You can't get away from it. How do you use it, and do, quotes, young people use it?
I think the research shows that they don't, as much as people in the 30s and 40s. I think they're the main users of Twitter. But I use it as if I won't put anything on there that I wouldn't want a prospective employer to see. people call it mind casting. I think that's a bit pretentious. But I tend not to do so much about what I'm kind of who I'm meeting in real life. I try and make it as relevant to as many people as I can, and tweet interesting links and have a conversation.
Or as Richard is. Yeah. If you're doing it as a journalist, I think that you can have a little bits of your personal life, but then if you crowd it with that, it makes it quite.
Yeah, I think that's a good IBM on their sorry, it's very boring. IBM on their social media policy have this quite interesting bit which just says, you know, just think about, you know, you're representing us and all these sorts of, but then they say at the bottom of their social media policy, this is IBM, so they are pretty locked down. They say anything that you add which is about yourself, which you feel might help to contextualise you as a person and make you more authentic. Because actually one of the things about the media is trust and transparency. And I sort of slightly agree with Richard that we have lots and lots of branded feeds. And actually I think that a blend of something which is people who recognise you as being from The Guardian but actually recognise you as an individual is important. I think journalists' personal brands are going to be incredibly important.
Yeah. How do you feel about Richard, about your personal power to influence people by what you say on Twitter?
It's an issue for me because I work for the BBC and I work for Five Live and I do programmes that are news-based. And it's difficult, and I think there's a grey area at the moment. I'll often retweet, you know, retweeting is you can put up a link to an article that I like. And but on occasion, I'll be retweeting a link to an article that may well express an opinion that I'm sympathetic towards. Mm. That's not the same as me expressing an opinion. But you could argue that it is. Now, that to me, this is a grey area that I imagine one day they'll legislate.
We're having a policy launched very soon at ITM to say what we can and what we can't.
There'll be some committee.
You're going to have non-tweet things that you cannot tweet.
We're going to have subjects we shouldn't tweet about, and also
are
to,
you
to look at how we. We're trying to keep the broadcasting code in what we tweet.
Right.
So don't express opinions.
So do you think
does that apply to you?
But what about that grey area that I mentioned?
I'm retweeting
a link to an article. Often I'm just saying, here's an interesting article. But look, occasionally, and I guess I did this with Jan Moyer, you're going, look at, you know, here's what Charlie Brooker says about Jan Moyer. And really, I agree with that. And so it's a grey area, and probably someone from BBC Trust will be listening to this podcast, and the rules will change, and I'll regret saying these words.
Do you know, BBC Trust really do? They really do listen to this podcast. They're so paranoid to listen to anything. Don't sack him, Sir Michael.
It's quite important, isn't it? For us, as, say at Channel 4 News, we're trying to get all of the correspondents to sign up to Twitter, but to actually know what you should and shouldn't be tweeting, because when I started doing it, I made mistakes. I've said things that I probably shouldn't have said. You've got to control that.
You're taking things down because you can delete.
Yeah, but you can't delete the retweets. And once someone's retweeted,
I think we're getting a picture. Hang on. We're getting a bit, you know, feeling a bit technical. Josh, how do you choose the people that you follow? Is it about their personality, or is it about what they say, or is it about what you're professionally interested in?
What they say and what I'm professionally interested in, really. I generally see people. I generally follow people if they're in a network. I find this lists function really good, but I'm aware of becoming involved in like an echo chamber. I don't want to be involved in an echo chamber. I want to embrace the serendipity that's part of the internet as well.
Let's leave Twitter there and look more broadly to the future. Before we hear from the panel on that, we've been out and about with our microphones during the conference today, and we asked. Where do people see themselves in 10 years' time?
I'm Alex Moss. I'm from Exeter. In 10 years' time, I hope to be writing for an English language paper in an African country, hopefully Ghana. I've had a long-standing interest in African history. I'm a history student, hoping to do a master's in African studies, and I think it will combine two passions I have very well.
My name's Anna. I am the chair of York University Media. If I could do anything, I would like to be the Director General of the BBC. But I imagine on a more realistic basis that in 10 years' time I'll probably be slaving away as a TV producer, earning a pittance and living in a shed somewhere in London.
My name's Laurie Whitwell. I'm from Leeds University. I want to be editing a major publication that reaches many, many readers and is worthwhile. It's not just something that is done for, you know, commercial gains that makes money. Something that actually people will read, take away and either learn something or find entertaining.
I'm Michael Copus and I'm from UCA Farnham. My 10-year ambition, well, hopefully I'll do it in a little bit quicker than 10 years, but come out of university and worm my way up the ladder, I suppose.
What particular ladder do you want to worm your way up?
I'd be very interested in working in newspapers, I think. I mean,
They're dead. Newspapers dead.
Yes, as much as it seems like it's a dying breed, I still kind of really like writing for a paper and seeing stuff in print. I'm sad enough to be the kind of person who goes out and buys CDs still and goes out and buys a newspaper, so maybe I'm just not fit for this world anymore at such a young age.
My name's Alice Solfield and I'm from Leeds University. I'd like to be a foreign correspondent for the BBC.
Alex Sharp from Exeter University.
What's your decade ambition?
To be a head sports writer for a paper, travelling the world watching tennis and football or soccer and reporting on it.
My name's Rhiannon Smith and I'm from Imperial College. In 10 years I want to be a science writer on a leading paper, getting to kind of find out all these really amazing new scientific facts and report them in a way that people can understand and get them excited about science as well.
My name's Tom Leader and I'm from UCA Farnham. Dream 10-year ambition would be become accidentally rich somehow, like some kind of amazing adventure. But my dream job would probably be like Five Live or something like that, sports side of it. That's all I'm interested, to be honest.
You're a sports guy?
Yeah. Can you not tell?
I'm Yogini and I'm from the University of Kent. In a decade, I'd like to be in the field of journalism, hopefully in my own home country, Zimbabwe. So I take this as a great opportunity to be here and to learn. I hope to make a difference and bring a different aspect of journalism to a country which has suffered terribly.
Jim Norton, I'm editor of York Vision.
What do you imagine that you might be doing in 10 years' time?
Work at The Guardian, do something on a podcast, hopefully the music one if they let me. So I'm going to try and get on and be a guest person on that. Get my name out there, hopefully write some stuff, and then become editor of The Guardian and good friends with Alan by the end.
Very ambitious people, Emily.
Really ambitious.
I'm quite scared. Right. Yeah. Also, I'm scared. They are quite ambitious. I'm worried about the one who wants to be director general of the BBC.
Why would you? Well, that doesn't look like a lot of fun.
I was going to say, does she not read the news? It's a really awful job.
Everyone knows what his wage come out
last
media.
Week. His wage did come out last week. That's you're right, go. Josh. Yeah, that would be the £800,000 probably swung it.
Very interesting. No one wanted to run a digital business.
No one said they were going to start their own publication, which is actually the easiest way.
I was going to say that. I would say I'm slightly disappointed because I just think if somebody said I'm going to have a microblogging empire and I've already started it and in 5 years' time...
It was very traditional.
Very traditional.
You've been, Emily, you've been known to gaze into crystal balls, haven't you, in your time?
No jokes.
What will the media landscape that those people and these people in this audience... in 5 or 10 years' time, what's it going to look like, do you think?
I think it's kind of... I mean, I come over all Clay Shirky in this, who's a big thinker about new media, who says everything is basically sort of broken, a bit broken or very broken at the moment, and we don't really know what's going to replace it. And it's not an optimist's kind of camp to be in. I'm a bit more optimistic than he is in that I think some very good things will come out of it. But I think there'll be a lot of many more sort of oddly kind of fragmented small kind of businesses. I mean, you already see this at local level actually happening. And then I think that sort of, you know, the established powers, and in the UK that's really the BBC and Sky, will still be kind of, you know, will still be pretty entrenched. I think the national newspaper market, I've said this before, so I'm not saying anything new, will be decimated. I think that you'll probably still see The Guardian because we've got a different ownership structure. News International titles
people,
probably.
You know, Telegraph will still be going.
I don't think so. I think in 10 years' time, I think the Telegraph may have disappeared.
Exist online. It's unlikely the brand would disappear.
But I think we have to think of the unthinkable. I think that actually when you look at a newspaper that's got, what, a kind of 800,000 circulation offline and, you know, kind of a fairly high readership online but hasn't got anything else around it, no. If it's a commercial business... But it's quite questionable.
But loads of newspapers haven't made money for donkeys. It's not a new thing that newspapers make money.
That's true, but the premium on the ownership of newspapers has always been about influence. Mm. Now, if you can buy influence now by having a yacht in Corsica and inviting people onto it, or owning a football club, you know, actually influence doesn't lie with the national press in the same way that it did, unless they do move online, which is actually an area which moves you into... actually sort of quite kind of choppy commercial waters. So if you're in it to make money, and actually most of the groups are,
Josh,
I think it's tricky.
Can you imagine, Josh, what kind of an industry the industry that you're going into will look like in five or 10 years?
No chance, not in 5 or 10 years. You can't imagine that, no. I mean, I'd like to see in that time a lot of new enterprises, news enterprises coming about. Like, it seems that they're all based in America at the minute. I'd like to see a lot more
UK-based. I think that needs to be something that's fed into journalism education. I think analysis and enterprise needs to be two of the things that are kind of focused on in the next phase of journalism education. Hyperlocal news, I mean, in 5-10 years, I'd be happy if I was running a hyperlocal news site. Mm. And I've started one at the minute, srtblog.com.
Get the plug in.
Is there traffic spike? Broken website. I've broken the website.
This is in Sunderland.
Sunderland. SR2 is my.
So you report website. On what?
Most of it is a lot of things that are published on a council website, but they don't get covered by the newspaper. They don't get covered by the BBC, anything like that. The residents' association meetings are kind of the bread and butter of hyperlocal news websites. That I always attend them, and there's always news coming out of them, and it's stuff that people actually care about.
Richard, do you imagine that Five Live will, I don't know, turn itself into a TV station? Because, you know, you're kind of sort of on the way there now.
Yeah, they toy with it a little bit. There's in one of the studios, they have cameras, and there's a tiny, quite cheap vision mixing piece of kit around the back, and it works.
I've been around. There's about three people gathered over this kind of console, isn't
it? I know, but have you seen it?
I have seen it.
It's like a sort of a mini briefcase thing, and it's all cheap and plasticky, but it does the job. It's not high quality television, but it works for the show that I'm going to take over in January. It could work for that show because we have interesting guests. And so if you're listening to the Archbishop of Canterbury chatting to Ricky Gervais, which happened last year on Five Live, about, you know, atheism, then you might also want to see that. It doesn't work for all radio shows because there's not a lot going on, but it does work for the ones where you have famous people, frankly.
I'm thinking Up All Night might not work quite so well.
People don't need to see what radio's going to be TV. Like.
But it'll only do that to a very limited extent because radio's just not a visual medium, is it? But I think it's interesting. Television's going to be very interesting over the next few years.
Ben?
When I joined Channel 4 News, I wrote a piece saying, I don't think this programme will exist in 10 years' time.
That can't make money. That doesn't make any money.
Channel 4 News doesn't make money. It's done for as a public service thing, and it makes a loss. I wouldn't say it's not going to exist at all, but I think that in the future there'll be the convergence between TV and online. We might be going to our internet-connected TVs and just watching the news stories that we care about that are interesting to us and not the stuff we're not interested in. The only thing that might save TV news is live interviews, but I'm not sure whether that works.
Live events generally on telly will have a premium.
We're going to be experimenting in how we can crowdsource a lot more on Channel 4 News and relate and reflect better what the audience want through innovative technology.
But the problem is, if you just go with what the audience want, you'll start doing less foreign news and you'll do loads on the X Factor.
Hmm. Potentially, but not necessarily the Channel 4 News audience.
All right. That's the future. We should stick with a bit of the present and look at, I suppose, what's the biggest media news story this week. This is certainly the one that's alighted, that's caused most chatter, and that's the proposed deal, Emily, with Murdoch wants to do with Microsoft, or does Microsoft want to do it with Murdoch? And they're going to delist from Google. So this is the idea that Rupert Murdoch would take all his traffic off of Google and his content off of Google and take it round the corner, round the back of the internet. To Bing. Is that going to work?
Well, he could do it any time he liked. There's, you know, very simple way of blocking search engine text from crawling your site.
Robots.txt.
TXT, yes, exactly. And everybody knows that this is a bit of a gamesmanship. He might delist from Google. Google will survive because, oddly, News Corp content is only a tiny bit of it. I think what he's really trying to do is push up the price that publishers get on search advertising listings. It's a very boring kind of market play, but because Rupert he's basically gunning for Google. He doesn't really like anyone who's kind of bigger and more influential in global communications markets than him. And he's been really, really successful at gaming those markets. He's sort of mistaken the internet for a market, and it's not. And so I think that he's going to. But you know, if he wants to try it, we're all happy to watch.
The thing is, if the revenue from the advertising you get from that search traffic is so low, then why not do this? Because
I mean, why not? If he doesn't, that's fine. I think if you
don't introduce the subscription anyway.
Yeah, if you don't, if you don't, you're absolutely right. If you don't want anybody to read your stuff, it doesn't matter where you are or aren't.
And actually, the thing is, the power of Google. We can say it's huge, but there's a billion clicks a month from Google News to news sites. But there's a billion clicks a month from news to news sites from Twitter. And I think where I would differ from you is just saying that I think
you sort of need to be everywhere. I think it's hard to reach serious news audiences these days, and I think if you want to do that, you have to be everywhere. I don't think that Murdoch really, you know, his digital brand is Sky. I'm much more interested in what he does with Sky because actually his newspaper and his newspaper websites are not. You know, they're not really what the digital game's about at News International.
No, did you see the piece in Vanity Fair about his plans to charge for online?
I was in that piece, yes.
Wasn't that interesting? But whoever wrote that said the
Michael Wolff.
Didn't he say that he thinks Murdoch's plan really isn't about digital media? It's to drive people back to the newspapers.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely. I think that's correct analysis. Because as I say, I think that he doesn't. You know. To him or James Murdoch, I mean, James Murdoch last week in Barcelona said newspapers will not be nearly as important in the future as they were in the past, and they're not as big a part of our business. And actually, you know, for them, getting as much money out of online and supporting sort of print for as long as they can and squeezing that market is absolutely what they're about. What they're not about, you know, if you're in a different position, say The Guardian or Channel 4 News or whatever, and you're... What you want is sustainability of the brand and reimagining it for digital. Probably approaching it in a slightly different way is the way to go. But as you say, you know, as Ben was saying, if you can come off these things or say I'm going to delist from Google, then do. I mean, I just don't think as big a deal.
Can I show you a piece of paper?
Cut them off.
It says cut them off. That's producer Ben. That's my talkback system. Thank you very much. You can read more news and analysis of the News Corporation and Bing and all the rest of that at mediaguardian.co.uk. Now, I think we've done enough talking. Let's see what the audience here has to say. And should we have the house lights up so I can see who you are? Oh, gosh, that's a bit scary. Shall we have a question from the guy in the blue shirt? Thank you.
Hi, there's been a lot of talk today about new media and specifically Twitter, but I feel like a lot of middle-aged news presenters and producers have really misjudged Twitter. It's not taking off with people from 15 to 25. I did a survey on my own newspaper about it, which is Palassan at the Durham newspaper, and literally the student body thinks that it's just like having an online subscription to Heat magazine. It's just a way of following celebrities. And it's not really about getting news and connecting with the world.
I think it's for people. Some of it's about celebrity. Some of it's people sort of my age up to these guys' age who think that they're quite cool by using it. I mean, you're totally right. Actually, news, whoever else, needs to be engaging in Facebook and Bebo and MySpace as well. But there is just something about Twitter because of the shortness of the message and because the fact that anyone can read it, unlike the other social networks where you have to be a friend. That makes it really good for news and spreading things quickly. But totally, it's still a very, very small niche. And people like, you know, we're looking, Channel 4 do a lot about Twitter, but we also need to do a lot about Facebook, and we are looking
at right at the back, Ben, black T-shirt. Say who you are, where you're from.
My name's Paul Garbutt. I'm a journalism student at the University of Sheffield and one of the editors of our student paper there. One thing that I just wanted to pick up on as we're coming to the end of today is that there is a lot of pessimism, isn't there, amongst journalists, the editors and so on, and also people right at the top of the industry about how we find a way out of this online crisis in the media. But one thing I think is, you know, we are seeing ways of making money off content. People have gone onto iTunes, been a massive success, iPhone applications, and even things like Spotify have shown that young people will actually look at ways of, you know, getting free content but listening to adverts and so on. Is it not this a massive opportunity for entrepreneurs of the future, that the next Rupert Murdochs and so on, to actually look at this and think we've got a new business model rather than saying we've got a media that's in crisis?
Emily.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I mean, if you look at America now, and I think we're about 18 months behind America in terms of probably the innovation cycle and in terms of the economic cycle, and you look at I mean, my old college mate Nick Denton, who's done exactly that, has got a kind of, you know, entrepreneurial business around blogging through Gawker. You look at the Huffington Post, you look at Talking Points Memo. You know, these are kind of places doing some relatively serious journalism of a different type to newspapers, but it's, you know, they're making money, or at least they're kind of paying their staff. And then you look at Demand and eHow and all of those new startups. And, you know, actually we make 10 times more out of digital media now than we did in 2002. And there isn't any other bit of our business which is growing at the rate of 10 times. But we are like the music industry, which is that actually this is not killing journalism. You know, it is going to kill bits of the cost base, you know, people like me, Richard. it will kill those bits of the industry, but it won't actually kill the...
No, people have overreacted and panicked. All it means is, as you say, that the business model just... has to evolve a little bit.
Yeah.
So it's rather than having adverts in the middle of a show, you put it, you see it on demand, and you watch a little advert at the beginning of the pit that you download, and that happens commonly and regularly.
And costs have got to come down. Yeah. I mean, that's the other thing, is that, you know, when I went into journalism, people were paid exactly the same as they are today. And I mean exactly the same. And that was, you know, bloody hell, that was like 22 years ago. So you kind of think that's like halving the real salaries of journalists. And that's going to, you know, that's probably going to continue. You know, we are quite an expensive business.
All right. Thanks very much for that. And thanks very much to you for your questions. Before we finish up, it has become customary for us to end the show with finding out what we've learned this week. But instead of that, I think we should ask our panel what's the best bit of advice that you can give our aspiring young hopefuls here today. Richard Bacon, I suppose it would be buy a flat in Salford.
I'm going to rent, Matt.
I was just going to ask, are you moving?
Yeah. No. I've signed a 3-year contract with Five Live,
yeah,
and that takes me into Manchester, but my show's 4 days a week, which means I'll be getting the train up Monday and coming back Thursday, so that's only 3 nights a week.
Right, okay.
I'm not really living very nice at Manchester, there in my only 3 nights a week.
Will the BBC be paying your train fares?
No, I'll be paying for those myself. Okay. And actually, having now been to the new BBC site, it's quite exciting. I think it's going to be a good place to be, and I think that a lot of media will shift up there and it'll become quite a focus. But in terms of the way into the media, for me, as I said earlier, BBC local radio is great. It was good for me, and I think it's still good. And it's the same reporters that you encounter at places like Five Live. And try and get work experience and work hard and get in that way, or just get involved in a massive scandal.
Richard, I can't imagine what you could possibly be thinking about, because you wouldn't have any experience with that at all. Ben, what's your piece of advice?
My overriding advice is, well, there's two things. One, start your own publication. Don't mess about waiting for an editor to commission you. I did the Pink News thing because the Times didn't commission me for a specific article, so I thought, screw it, I'll just publish it myself. And things just grow. And you can start your own thing. You can be your own editor. And you will be able to... You'll be lean enough to get through all this mess in the media industry because you haven't got all that old huge cost base. You'll only be paying yourself. Don't pay yourself for a bit. Make a great site and then make loads of money from search ads and Google ads or something like that, or an iPhone app.
Emily Bell, that's quite good advice, isn't it?
It's very good advice. I was going to say do it yourself, do it better, but Ben sort of said
that. So that's much longer and long-winded thing.
Focus. That's the other thing I'll say. Just focus. Focus, 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 focus.
Josh?
Find one thing you can do better.
Josh, what's... I suppose you're taking all this advice, aren't you?
Absolutely, yeah, I'm on the receiving end of it. I'd echo what Ben said about starting your own publication. I mean, I don't think it's necessarily that impressive to have been an editor at a student paper anymore. I think you, it's more impressive to have started your own publication. I mean, get your friends together who you live with. You likely live in a student area. I know I do. Get all your friends that are pitched around the area and start a hyperlocal news site up, see what works. It might work. It might come to the attention of someone who likes what you're doing. All you can do is try really hard. I mean, you're fighting against the biggest amount of people you'll be competing with for jobs ever. You just got to stand out. I mean, just work hard.
All right, thank you very much. Fantastic. Please show your appreciation to all our panellists for giving up their time and only for a modest fee. For all of you back at home, post a comment on our blog at guardian.co.uk/mediatalk. Find us on Facebook and Twitter. Media Talk is produced by Ben Green. I'm Matt Wells. Goodbye.